Lápis. Z2 gauge theory. Okay, so we started from a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. Which, in other words, means that this lattice is wrapped around the torus in this way. And we place spin half on the edges of the lattice everywhere so that our total Hilbert space is just the tensor product of all the spins that are 2L squared that are on the lattice. Then we define a gauge transformation at the site N. Okay? What it does is to flip all the spins that come out from this site. And I use this notation. All the L's that belong to the site N, we operate with sigma x. Okay? And then the gauge invariant Hilbert space is by definition the set of states that are invariant under the gauge transformation. And this is what is the we call the physical Hilbert space. So these degrees of freedom are fictitious, the spins, and these are the physical ones. And of course, the dimension of the original Hilbert space is 2 to the 2L squared. And we computed last time the dimension of the gauge of the Hilbert space of the gauge theory, and we saw that it is 2L squared plus 1. And so also last time we saw that there is a global constraint on these transformations, namely that the product of all the gauge transformations is the identity. And this is because of the periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so we saw that this is the actual dimension of the Hilbert space. And we wanted to find the basis for this Hilbert space. And so we found the convenient basis in this way. So I can write it as the span, which means just the set of all the linear combinations of the basis states over the complex field, of course. So what are the basis states? Are diskettes in which my quantum numbers are the eigenvalues of these operators B1, BL squared minus 1, where B is associated to a plaquette. And it is the product of z, of sigma z around the plaquette. Okay? So this is a good quantum number because it commutes with the gauge constraint. Okay? So these are gauge invariant quantities. We cannot label states inside this space with quantities that are not gauge invariant. And similarly, the same global constraint also holds for the product of all these BPs. So if the product of all of them is 1, this means that the product of all the eigenvalues is 1. So this means that once you fix L squared minus 1 such eigenvalues, the last one is determined by the fact that the product of all the others must be 1. So that's why we'll have only L squared minus 1. Plus, we have 2 other eigenvalues that are the eigenvalues of these 2 operators. So let me draw this string. It is a closed string, but it's non-contractible because it's this string, right? Let me call it gamma 1. So let me also put it in color. Okay. And this other one in the other direction, let me call it gamma 2. Okay. And we saw that we can associate 2 operators. Let me call them WZ 1, 2, namely the product of sigma Z on all the spins belonging to gamma 1 or 2. So this is the operator. Also, this operator has 2 eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. Many times degenerate, but there is the subspace where 1 is plus and the subspace when the other one is minus. And there are loops, right? So we know that everything that is a loop has to commute with our gauge structure. And it is independent of the Bs, because every product of Bs does a loop that is of this type. Namely, it's contractible. So these 2 operators are independent, and they commute with a gauge constraint. So they are also good quantum numbers. Okay. So you see that we have L squared minus 1 plus 2 equal L squared plus 1 quantum numbers. Each of them has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. Which exactly label all the 2 L squared plus 1 to the L squared plus 1 states. Because every configuration of this number, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, minus 1, so on and so forth, is a state that is inside here, and they're all orthogonal. Right? And the last thing we said last time was that, okay, so the gauge invariant Hilbert space is the tensor product of all these Hilbert spaces that have this support. And we see that they're mostly local, but there are 2 that are non-local. They involve the whole lattice. So this Hilbert space is not local. And we might feel uneasy with this because we spend some time saying things like, oh, you know, all physics should be made of local physics. And these Hilbert spaces are not. But, okay, so why it should be made of a local physics? So this is this in itself is not a physical fact. It's a principle, and we wonder whether this principle is really always obeyed in quantum physics or not. One might question the reality of the Z2 gauge theory. Maybe it doesn't exist in reality. Okay. So there are 3 possibilities. Either this thing cannot exist, or it exists the way it is, then we have to accept that it's non-local. Or there is a third possibility that this is the effective theory of a local theory. So that somehow this, the gauge structure can emerge. And we will see it. That it is possible for the gauge structure to emerge. Okay, so we are not presenting, so this, so far we have only shown the Hilbert space. Okay, so we have not the theory yet, right? The theory is a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian. And you remember that we defined the classical gauge theory, and that it was just the sum over all, our energy was the sum over all the plaquettes, right? Because they are the gauge invariant quantities. So to do the quantum Hamiltonian, now we could do two things. One is to do the transfer matrix method, apply it to the lattice classical gauge theory, and see how the mapping translates into some quantum theory. And if we do that, we should start from the Ising lattice gauge theory in 3D, because we already saw that the two-dimensional one is trivial, doesn't have different faces. Okay? And also, we know from the classical quantum mapping that if you want to land onto something that has this Hilbert space that is in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, we must start from the one in 3D. So that is one route. But so it is again, you know, trying to find the right transfer matrix. Or we can follow a different method that is faster, and it is just let's put in the Hamiltonian all the gauge invariant quantities that we know that are as local as possible. Well, so one is this, right? This is the gauge invariant quantity. So let me write it explicitly that Gn and Bp commute always. And you remember why they commute, right? Why they commute? Yeah, so sigma z and sigma x do not commute, but
they share at most two edges or zero edges.
Yeah, they always share either zero or two edges, so they are bound to commute. Okay, so let's say that we have minus j, the sum over all these operators. So is this, now in the quantum case, are these all the gauge invariant quantities? So by gauge invariant, I mean they must commute with this operator. So what else there is? G itself? Okay, G itself on this Hilbert space does nothing. This is the Hilbert space where G is the identity. So G, yeah, you can put in the Hamiltonian, but does nothing. Okay. It's a constant. So what else? Okay, these guys, you mean, right? Or the ones with X? Okay, but my requirement is that we still want the Hamiltonian to be as local as possible. So, these are kind of not local. Oh, so let me add something, because it is true that these two guys have two eigenvalues plus one and minus one, but to treat them as spins, I should show that there is some operator that anti-commutes with them and they realize the polyalgebra. And you can easily see that if I take these loops on the dual lattice and I put sigma x here, you see? This and this, they commute, anti-commute, because they meet only once. So whereas the the contractible loops are bound always to commute. The non-contractible ones may anti-commute. So this means that if I want to change this quantum number, I have to operate with this long operator. So, okay, that put aside. What are the other operators that commute with the GN? Just look at GN. What is it? This guy. Anything that contains sigma x will commute with it. Right? Any sigma x would commute with it. So the most local term that contains sigma x is sigma x itself. So I can put this term like this. So now you see that GN and this Hamiltonian commute. So this means that the Hamiltonian respects the gauge structure. We have learned that the gauge structure is not a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. It's a structure. And this is important because otherwise we know that if the energy would not commute the gauge structure, then operating with the Hamiltonian on some physical state would bring us out of our physical space that is the gauge invariant Hilbert space. Yep.
So the second term you've written, it can be any function of sigma x.
Yes, but our requirement was as local as possible.
But
it could be any function of sigma x. This is the most local one.
Why would higher orders not be as local?
Because sigma x is less local than just sigma x. It has a bigger support. We know very well how to measure how local something is, right? It's the diameter of the support of the single terms in the Hamiltonian. So this is one body, basically, and yep.
So what would you find an operator over Bouquet, but sigma y? Like the analog of BP, but with, say, sigma y.
So you want to define a Plaquette operator sigma y? And so sigma y as Plaquette, let me see. Yeah, would also commute. Yeah. I could add, but actually basically wouldn't give you no really physical difference from this. The algebraic relationships of sigma y with sigma x are pretty much the same than sigma z with sigma x. So, yeah, I could add one more term and get another theory. But this is the minimal one, right? Then you could choose sigma z or sigma y inside here.
However, I couple, for example, a term with brackets of sigma y. Isn't like analogous to having the Ising model and the xy model, where I have in the Ising model just sigma sets and sigma x's. And in the XY model, I have sigma set, sigma y, and sigma x. And the physics is different, right?
Yeah, it would be another theory. Yes, that maybe the analogy. So I in some sense, I see the analogy. But so the important part of in what sense the XY model is an interesting generalization of the Ising model is that the procedure that we know to diagonalize it works exactly the same. And here, this model is not exactly solvable. And I will show you why it's not exactly solvable. So yeah, it's an interesting analogy, but there is nothing to be conserved to start with, that is this procedure by which I diagonalize. Okay, so if you start from the 3D classical Ising gauge theory, and you do the classical quantum mapping using the transfer matrix method, you would land exactly in this. Okay. So we know that this theory has a phase transition at finite temperature. So now we know that then this theory must have a quantum phase transition at the zero temperature for some critical value of G. We know it from all this knowledge that we acquire in how the classical quantum mapping works. But we could see also directly, okay? We could see directly in this way. So let's first see at the two limits, G much greater than 1 and G equals 0. So for G much greater than 1, well, our theory is a very well known and easy theory. It's just the paramagnet. Right? So we know that the ground state is unique. We know that there is a gap. And therefore, by the Lib-Matisse-Schutz theorem, correlation functions will decay exponentially with some correlation length psi. Okay? And there is nothing else to say. This is a very uninteresting theory. But let's look at the G much smaller than 1, and in particular, G equals 0. Yep.
So G greater than 1 is greater than J, right?
Yep.
And for the correlation function, it should be sigma x. And for the correlation function, it should be sigma x.
No. They are not good. Because sigma x is not a gauge invariant. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's the other way around. Sigma z. These are the good correlation functions. What your colleague justly noticed that sigma z is not a gauge invariant operator, and so we do not expect non-gauge invariant operator to have any sensible expectation value because of the Elitsov theorem, right? But in fact, we should show it. So let me show it aside here. So the Elitsov theorem says not gauge invariant quantities must have zero expectation value. Right? Otherwise, I would have a magnetization, which cannot happen. In fact, without even invoking the gauge symmetry, in the paramagnet, we already know that it's disordered. We already know that the average of sigma z in the ground state is 0. No magnetization, right? We are in the paramagnet phase. But the Elitsov theorem says that in everywhere, no matter what is the value of G. But we saw the Elitsov theorem in the classical case, right? So let's see how it becomes in the quantum case. In the quantum case, it's almost trivial because we have expelled from at the Hilbert space level the states that do not obey the gauge constraint. The only states that might have some non-trivial expectation value for non-gauge invariant operator are not there. So these are words, but in formula, how do you do that? Imagine that you want to compute sigma z, or correlation functions of sigma z, anything that is not gauge invariant in the ground state. Now I use the fact that psi 0 is gauge invariant. Okay? So when I do this average, I can also do this average in another configuration that is the gauge transform, exactly what we did in the classical case. But in the quantum case, this is easy to write. Right? I just need to do this. Oh. Right. So I want to compute sigma z in the ground state of the gauge invariant theory. So by definition, this ground state is invariant under a gauge transformation. Now what do we do? Now, because this is true for every n, imagine that the L that I am, whose expectation value I'm computing is this one. I can, so this expression is also true for this n. The n such that L comes out from n, right? So in this case, what happens between Gn and sigma zl? So gn is x, 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 sigma zl is this. What do they do? Huh? They anti-commute, right? So this means that if I pass this thing to this, I get a minus. So I have a minus, psi 0, sigma zl, g dagger, and g dag, g. And you can check that this operator is unitary, so this is the identity. Right? And this is just a product of sigma x, so it's unitary. Or in other words, you know that sigma x square is the identity, and it's Hermitian as an operator, so sigma da G dagger is just again sigma x. So this is the proof. So just like in the classical proof of the Elitz theorem, this magnetization is equal to minus the same magnetization. So it must be 0. So also in this phase, sigma zl must be 0 because of the Elitz theorem. So you remember this was our quandary from the beginning. If magnetization is 0 in both phases, why do we say that there is a phase to start with? Okay, we did see that there are two phases in 3D. So we expect here to be two phases as well. If you compute the expectation value of large Wilson loops, so W associated to some loop C, in this phase you see something that goes like e to the minus the area that is inside the C. And here you would see the perimeter law. And this would come from the classical quantum math. So there must be two phases. But we can also see without looking at the mapping. At that mapping, we can look at another mapping. That is interesting. So this other mapping is the following. Let me draw the lattice again. Yeah.
When you take the expectation value of those Wilson loops, it's for any Wilson loop?
or just for the non-contractible ones?
Very good. For the non-contractible, sorry, for the
contractible ones.
For any contractible
ones. So, yeah, the non-contractible ones, they in the ground state, they have a fixed expectation value that is either plus one or minus one, right? Because they are in the basis. The contract, so that's, you remember yesterday, I called them C when they're contractible. So let me, contractible. So I want to show you that there are indeed two phases, and also that this theory is not exactly solvable. And we will do another mapping. So the mapping that we do is the duality mapping. So remember we did the duality on the Ising chain. And we saw that the quantum Ising chain is self-dual. Now we do the same mapping. So duality. And the model is not self-dual, but let's see what it is dual to. So just as we, in the Ising model, which we defined some starting point for our chain, somewhere in the chain, and then we mapped the chain in the dual chain. So here, what is the dual lattice? So this is the original lattice. The dual lattice is the lattice where the sides are the plaquettes. So let me define a starting point here that I call 0. And then a string that lands here. Remember, we defined the string on the dual lattice. So only here we have to be a little bit more careful with the notation because we have two directions that are x and y. So when I define this string, I have to say whether it's this string or this string that goes in the y direction. So on the dual lattice, I can define two new variables. The first one, mu1, we like them to call them mu, so that at p, so now the sides in the dual lattice are the plaquettes, right? So at p, we associate this operator. And now the other one, mu3 of p. And now we have to decide whether this p is coming from this direction or this direction. So we should put another label that is mu. So, sorry, mu is bad. Nu. Nu having the values x or y. And we say that this is the string that goes from 0 to p. In the new direction. Okay? So when nu is equal x, and this is my p, this operator is just the product of sigma x here, here, and here. Where when p is this, and I'm going in the new direction, my mu3 is the operator that operates with the sigma x here and here. So what does happen to my HZ2? It maps to what? OK. So the first part is easy. It's minus j. So let me call it the new h. It's minus j mu1 of p. the second part is minus jg. Okay, just sigma x. And now you see that when sigma x, so sigma x can be on a vertical link or on an horizontal link. When sigma x is on a vertical link, so sigma x of L on a vertical link, L belongs to the set of vertical links. Look, this is equal to the product of, so let's say it's this one, of this string times the string that goes a little bit early. So this is equal to mu 3 L nu x, sorry, mu 3 L plus 1 x. It is exactly the same that we did in the chain. We just need to carry this notation around to say in what direction it's happening. And when L is on a horizontal link, it's the same thing, but in the y direction. So now this becomes the sum over all the L and all the mu, all the nu having value. First we do all the horizontal links and then all the vertical links, or what? Mu 3 L nu, mu 3 L plus 1 nu. Oh, what is this? Icing in 2D. So by duality, the Z2 gauge theory maps onto the quantum icing in a transverse field in 2D. And we know that this theory, by the classical quantum mapping, is the classical icing in 3D, which is not exactly solvable. And it has a phase transition that is difficult to locate, because now in 2D, we do not have self-duality. I just showed you that by duality, the 2D goes in the lattice gauge theory. So the diagram is the following. We have icing gauge 3D. So this is the classical level. This is the quantum level. So this mapping, this is the classical quantum mapping. And this is the quantum Z2 gauge theory. Then we have the duality. And this is the quantum icing. So all this level is quantum. So it's one dimension less than this one. So this is all 2D. And this is all 3D. And again, we have the classical quantum mapping. And this is the icing, not gauge, just icing in 3D. So this means that there must be some duality transformation also here to close the diagram. Quite neat. Okay, so now that we know that so I have to be precise. As you can see, in this way, I can map my the expectation values of these objects, basically, in mu 1. So I have forgotten about my non-local degrees of freedom. I have not mapped them. So the duality is not mapping them. So this means that I first go in the subspace in which w1 and w2 are fixed. So I fix the value of those two operators. So I get stuck in one of these sectors. Each of those sectors is mapped into a quantumizing 2D. So now let's look at this model from the point of view of what we know, right? We know that when G is large, we are in the, so when G is large, now we have spontaneous symmetry breaking, right? When G is small, we are in the paramagnet, and when G is large, we have a spontaneous symmetry breaking. In other words, this is the Higgs phase of our gauge theory. I have and so in this, so mu 1 has expectation value 0, whereas now mu 3 has expectation value that is either plus 1 or minus 1. Okay? So mu 3 is different from 0. There is magnetization. So now I can use this fact to understand what is the order parameter here. Because I can translate it. So this means that in the gauge phase, what is different from zero is the product, is my string operator. So this is for G much greater than 1, right? When mu 3, it's for G big that there is spontaneous symmetry breaking in the mu variables. So in other words, when G is very large, so when in the original theory, the external magnetic field prevails, we have the so-called kink condensation, because each of these strings will, what will it do? Will excite a plaquette. You see, each of these strings will not commute with the plaquette that is at the end. So this means that the ground state, instead of being the ground state where all the BPs are one, will be the ground state where there is a proliferation such that the average is non-zero of BPs being not being minus one. Yeah.
It shouldn't be for G smaller than one, but you have mu three different from zero. Because for G large, then you have the set two symmetric phase, right?
For G large, look here. Right. When is that mu three gets a non-vanishing expectation value when G is large, when you are in the icing phase. This is where you have symmetry breaking. Just remember, sigma z, sigma x. Right? It is in this phase that you have symmetry breaking.
And which sigma z spontaneously, sigma z is what we call mu 3, as a non-zero expectation value. Okay, so what we learn is the following. Let's go back to our HZ2. So first of all, we know learned that there is a QPT because there is a QPT in the quantumizing mode. We know that there is, because there is symmetry breaking there. Then for G larger than 1, there is, so let me go first. For G equals 0, so for G equals 0 is when our Hamiltonian is just the sum over all the plaquettes. The minimum energy is when all the BPs are 1, right? So the ground state is such that all the BPs are 1. Why is that? Because every time BP is 1, I get an energy minus J, right? When it is minus 1, I get an energy that is plus J. So the minimum energy is minus J times L square. Every time I excite a plaquette, I have, if for a certain B tilde, BP is equal minus 1, then the energy associated to this will be equal to minus J L square plus 2J. And moreover, the ground state is four-fold degenerate. Why? So what is the ground state? The ground state is BP1 is equal plus 1. All the BP are plus 1.
There are four possibilities in with which you can.
And because these quantum numbers here can be plus 1 or minus 1, and the energy doesn't change. The energy doesn't change because these things are not in the Hamilton. Okay? So the span of these four states is what we call the ground state manifold. So you see it's four-fold degenerate. There are four states. And thanks to the mapping, we learn another thing, is that, I need to tell you something else before I can prove that. So this is for G exactly equal to 0. There are four degenerate states. What happens when I perturb this state and I switch G small, but different from 0. So in principle, I could split this degeneracy, right? And I am wondering, so when is that I don't split the degeneracy? When my perturbation has some symmetry that the Hamiltonian has, right? Then it can happen. And in this case, we wonder, because sigma x does obey the gauge symmetry. So it might happen that sigma x does not split the gauge. However, products of sigma x may split this degeneracy. In fact, we know that the long product of all the sigma x's around the non-contractible loop is what changes the quantum number W1 for plus 1 to minus 1. So it's exactly the operator that connects the two ground states, right? So that's exactly the operator that will split the degeneracy. So whether the degeneracy is split or not, that does not depend on the symmetry considerations. However, so when you do perturbation theory, in order to be a splitting, you have to find that. So you have your W1 state, let's say, plus 1, and your other state, W1, being minus 1. What must happen is that your perturbation at some order connects these two states. So you know that the degenerate perturbation theory tells you that if this matrix element is 0, then there is no splitting. And indeed, what is our perturbation? Is G sigma x. When n is equal to L, the sides of the system, this to the n contains the long product of sigma x. And before it doesn't. So the splitting happens at the L order in perturbation theory. Okay. So the splitting delta E is G of the order G to the L. And because we are examining the situation in which G is much smaller than 1, right? It's a perturbation. This is E to the minus L over some correlation length chi. So you see that not because of symmetry, but in the thermodynamic limit, this goes to 0. So this the fourfold degeneracy is robust even when I switch on G. At some point, when G is too big, perturbation theory collapses. Why? Because we know that there is a quantum phase transition. We know that the gap between the ground state and the first excited state will shrink to 0. So we cannot use perturbation theory anymore. So this argument fails. So we cannot argue that there is a fourfold degeneracy for every value of G. But pretty much until the quantum phase transition happens, this is true. So the whole phase for small g is, we call it topological, because we have this situation that we have a gap and four states that are distinguished by these long operators that wrap around the torus, so they are topological. So now let's look at correlation functions in this limit of G much smaller than 1. So I want to see correlation functions of, say, sigma xi, sigma xj. So we know that for when g is equal to 0, okay, now we can already, just because of the Elitzur theorem, we know that this must be 0, okay? So what I wanted to say is that imagine that now I can violate my gauge constraint a little bit, so that these things are not bound to be 0 because of the Elitzur theorem. But if I look at my mapping, this is equal to mu p plus 1. Which mu was it? The 1? mu q plus 1. Where P is the plaquette near I and Q is the plaquette near J. Okay? So now this is an operator based at P, and this is an operator based at Q, which is local. And now we are, when G is much smaller than 1, which means in the phase where our mapping tells us that the ground state is unique. So there is a unique ground state and a gap. So we know that these correlation functions have to decay like e to the minus the distance between q and p over xi. Of course, when I do this, I'm making an error of this type, because this is only true if I am stuck in that sector that sector where the two w's are fixed, which happens with an error that is of this order, right? Because this is the tunneling. This gives me the tunneling amplitude between those sectors. So, but we know that in the thermodynamic limit, this goes to zero. So the only piece that survives is this. So we have shown that, so for the exact gauge theory, correlation functions of non-gauge invariant quantities are identically zero. But if we could violate a little bit our gauge structure, they would be exponentially decaying. So we would have the situation in which we have a gap, a non-unique ground state, and exponentially decaying correlation function. So, and this is all because we are beyond symmetry breaking. Because we know that when there is a symmetry breaking, there is a long range order. These correlation functions will not be decaying exponentially. And the point is that when you have symmetry breaking, it is easy to tunnel from here to here. It's our initial argument of the fact that the coherence is very easy. Because different states can be connected by local operators. At least you can destroy their phase relations using local operators. But now these four states are completely disconnected unless you use a large topological operator. So we now see how all these things come together. Because our theory is not a theory of symmetry breaking, which is obtained by the fact that we enforce a local constraint to our Hilbert space, which cannot be spontaneously broken, then if we obtain a degeneracy, this degeneracy cannot be easily lifted. And what does the degeneracy depend on? It depends on the fact that because you have boundary conditions of a certain type, then there exist large operators that do not commute. But they commute with the Hamiltonian. So they give you another state with the same energy. So it's because there is a hole. If I take a lattice that is not exactly square, and they put periodic boundary conditions to make it a sphere, then there are no such operators. And there is a unique ground state. On the other hand, if I do, again, I modify my lattice a little bit, and they put two holes, then I have two pairs. Four pairs, because for every hole I have two pairs, right? That give me a fourfold degeneracy. And this is repeated also here. So in general, the degeneracy so we saw that on a torus is 4. Because for each hole, I get 4 states. On a generic Riemann surface of genus G, the genus is the number of holes, of handles, is 4 to the G. So on a sphere is 1, on a torus is 4, and I can have as many as I want. And this degeneracy is always robust for the same reason, because to connect, to tunnel from one state to another, I have to use a long operator. And if my Hamiltonian is local, to make a long operator, I have to go to a high order in perturbation theory, which means it's exponentially small. And all this is true at zero temperature. Right? We're doing perturbation theory and finding the new ground state. So one question that we will talk a little bit about tomorrow will be what happens at non-zero temperature. Right? We want to see if these effects survive. This would be very interesting if they survive in non-zero temperature. Okay, so tomorrow we'll see. Other questions? Yeah.
How your the result of the degeneracy having 2 to the 2G depends on having your surface to be compact, right?
Yeah.
But what happens if I consider the same thing in a cylinder?
Yeah.
I'll just have just one Wilson loop. And in that case, the degeneracy will be only 2. I mean,
so on the infinite cylinder,
you have 2 states because you have another. You have this endless string. But if it is a finite cylinder, then you have to fix what are the boundary conditions. But for every fixture of the boundary conditions, you have a different theory which has a unique ground state.